Welcome, everyone, to episode 81 of Underserved. With me today is Amanda Richardson, CEO at CoderPad. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Awesome. Excited to be here, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
So way back in UVA, you weren't thinking of running a software company. You were thinking of being an astronaut, right?
That's right. I started in the physics program and I still want to be an astronaut. My calculus skills aren't good enough to get me there. I'm going to have to figure out how to pay my way up to space or Mars or wherever we end up going. But I'm ready. I'm ready. We'll get there.
So you graduate, first job in New York?
Yeah. So I graduated because I couldn't survive the physics program. I ended up with a finance degree because that was the department that would take me, and ended up in New York doing long short equity hedge funds, of all things. My first day of work was September 10th, 2001, which was a fine day. The next day was the worst day. So that was kind of a crazy time to start, but it was 4 years of really trying to understand how businesses work, how you could, you know, make value and understand what trends were and talking to customers and a lot of the things that actually I do today, but just in a very different approach.
I think it's always good in your first job to have someone else pay you to make all the mistakes and learn everything.
No, I made a ton of mistakes. It was a great first job just because, you know, you worked hard, you're excited, you want to learn all sorts of different things. But it was also like that first job where you didn't know what you didn't know, right? And so I'm out just cold calling people and asking them about technology trends and what they're using. And I guess, you know, it taught me to be brave enough to always ask the stupid questions because I didn't even know they were stupid at the time. I was just like, how does that even work? That doesn't make any sense to me. I'm 22. I have no idea what you're talking about. And it turns out I'm now a little bit older. We'll leave the number out, but I still don't know what I'm talking about. And so I can still ask the questions of like, what is it that you're trying to say?
You can't be afraid to ask the questions ever.
No.
But you come to a juncture and say, you know what, I think I'm going to go to grad school. Where do you go?
Yeah. So my boss at the time really encouraged all of us to go get our MBAs so that we could better understand how the world works and understand how companies work. Of course, I thought I knew everything, but I ended up going to Stanford out here in California. And it took about a week on campus for me to realize I was never going back to Manhattan. It's just too perfect out here.
I've heard people describe it that there's just a buzz and energy about it that's like nowhere else. Was that your experience?
Yeah, I think it was just what my eyes were open to is I had spent all this time in New York studying how people run businesses and trying to understand how people were building products. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, these people are actually doing it. No one's talking about it. No one's doing spreadsheets about it. They're like hands on keyboard, getting out there and doing it. And it's such like an open-minded, some would say crazy place where you can try anything and the craziest idea gets kind of a high five and like, great, we're rooting for you, as opposed to so much of my life had been around like, oh my gosh, that's a crazy idea. Why would you do that? And it's just open-minded, it's energizing, and it's just the sky is truly the limit out here. We will take on any challenge, right, wrong, or indifferent.
I've always thought that the West had this kind of like explorer prospector mentality to its folks, you know, that are like willing to take a chance.
Oh, totally. I mean, if many of our origins come from people who were fleeing countries who didn't want them, I mean, the people on the West Coast are the ones who fled the people on the East Coast who didn't want them. So I don't know if we're explorers or rejects out here. And I'm admittedly one of the later ones to get out here, but for sure, I go home and my family just looks at me like, you are truly nuts. You are really a Californian now.
Did you take any engineering classes while you were doing your MBA?
So I took some engineering classes undergrad and at my MBA. My first language of choice, other than Logo 2 in elementary school, for those who remember, was C++. But some of the engineering schools at Stanford were just so impactful because other than, you know, engineering concepts, which are certainly helpful, they brought an aspect of leadership to the conversation that I think had been missing from some of my other schooling. And so, you know, often in the business school, they would bring in in great CEOs and great leaders. And that's kind of expected at a business school. But in the engineering school, they brought in all of these entrepreneurs who were talking about how they figured out, you know, the early days of Yahoo, the early days of AOL, the early days of Firefox and Mozilla, like some of the companies that hadn't really been held up from a business perspective necessarily as like revolutionary businesses, but were great engineering feats. And so the engineering school was always bringing in these leaders and really promoting innovation, not just innovation from like lines of code and software output, but like innovation and how you can use software to really change the world. And it was so exciting. I mean, every week was a new speaker and it was just, I was so excited to go. We called it across the street because the business school is on one side and kind of the rest of the university is on the other. And it was just so exciting to just feel that buzz. Like if there's a buzz in California, there's a big buzz in Palo Alto. And if it buzzes in Palo Alto, it's definitely in the engineering school.
Now, were there any other classes you took while you were there that you thought were particularly helpful later on in your career?
I mean, I think at the time I would have given you a very different answer, but looking back now, there were two classes, one around organizational dynamics, which sounds as dry as it is, but actually really matters in terms of how you organize teams and kind of organize functions. And then the other one that is famous at Stanford is called touchy-feely. So it was more about, you know, how you have hard conversations and interpersonal dynamics and building relationships and building trust. And it was hard. I actually got my lowest grade ever in interpersonal dynamics. Fun fact. I'm not sure what that says about me. I like to say it's because I didn't advance enough. I was already pretty advanced, but I'm not sure my husband would share that feedback. But it was a great class just for, you know, really having hard conversations and beginning a path of management that is really all day long about hard decisions, hard conversations, and rallying a group of people who have no reason to listen to you other than you want them to, and trying to convince them to head in a direction, which is not that easy, as you know.
So after grad school, you get a job in California. Where are you working?
So out of grad school, I met a guy who had just become the CEO of a software company. Now, we had coffee at this university cafe on University Avenue in Palo Alto, which is like infamous and famous all at the same time. We met for 45 minutes. He seemed like a great guy, Andy Eckert. And he was like, great, you have the job. And I was like, well, wait a minute. Like, I thought this was supposed to be like an interview process. Like, what do you mean I have the job? He's like, we'll figure it out. And so began my career of we'll figure it out all along the way. And so I was the director of business development, which I had no idea what that meant. I had to call somebody and was like, I don't even know what those people do. And they were like, don't worry, it's kind of a nonsense title anyway. No offense to our business development friends. And I started at Eclipsys, which was a hospital software company, doing basically a little bit of M&A, a little bit of partnership, a little bit of strategic planning, and really trying to learn the industry and learn the software.
What does their software do?
If you've ever been to the hospital and I don't know, you've had a surgery, you've had whatever, and the nurse is asking you questions and typing into the computer, that's what we did, your electronic health record. So we were the health record of choice at the time for leading academic hospitals. So Hopkins and NYU, Presby and BMC and some of these most famous hospitals where world-class researchers and doctors are working. That was our software back in 2006, which was nuts because they all had their own data centers and on-prem, and we were literally shipping CDs. I mean, it was funny to talk about today, but that was how software was done back then.
It seems kind of intense, though, high stakes. Like if something goes wrong, someone can have some bad consequences.
Suddenly a hotfix took on a whole new meaning, particularly when you're shipping the software on CDs, right? So there's latency, but it's also like somebody can die. We had a cancer center one time, like go offline through an upgrade. And I remember flying somebody, the only seat we could get was this first class seat. And we had to get two of them, one for the consultant and one for the computer to go out there to reboot the cancer center to bring them back online. It was way too intense. It was a very stressful job. The people who are working in healthcare are amazing saints, and I am not cut out for that path.
So you did do some strategy presentations to the board there, making use of that MBA. How was that?
I did. Yeah, I know. This is what you get. I was there for 3 months and Andy was like, hey, let's do, you know, kind of your market assessment and figure out build, buy, partner, and what markets do we need to enter? And it was, you know, kind of your classic analysis. I actually got my nickname there, Demanda. I remember I was leading a team or working on a team to put together the strategy presentation, and we had a preview with the CEO the next morning. And, you know, the deck was long, right? This is like very strategy work, 60 pages, whatever. And we'd piece things together and references, and the fonts were a mess. It's like 10 o'clock at night. And one of the guys was like, hey, let's go get dinner. And I was like, but this is a mess. The fonts are all wrong. This doesn't match. What are we going to do? And he was like, who cares? I was like, we cannot present this to the CEO. And he was like, you know what you are? You're Demanda. I'm out of here. And I was like, fine, I'm going to fix it. So I stayed up till 3 a.m. fixing the fonts. And that's what I did. And I hope he had a lovely dinner. And he's still a dear friend. But that's where I got that nickname.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
So after Clipsys, you move on to Snagajob?
Yeah, so I decided hospital software wasn't for me. And during my time at Clipsys, I moved out of business development into product management. And I think one of the things I loved about product management was talking to the users and imagining what was possible. But what I hated was how much intensity and stress there was around hospital software. You know, every change had to be QA'd again, you know, because people can die. And it was just a very intense, laborious, slow process. And so I got a call from Snagajob to go do some consumer work. And so I jumped back into business development, was going to be in, you know, get out of the product management, go back to doing these partnerships and board presentations and fixing my fonts or whatever it was that I did. And I'd been at Snagajob for 2 or 3 months. The CEO walked into my office and was like, hey, I need someone to just take over product management for the next couple of months while I hire a head of product management. You're the only one in the building who's done this. Can you just do it for a couple months? And I was like, oh, I just left product management. I don't want to deal with these engineers again. And I said, fine, I'll do it for just 3 months. And that was, I think, probably at least 15 years ago. And so embarked a long product management career.
Sounds like The Godfather. Every time I try and get out, they pull me right back in.
Exactly. Yes. Every product manager loves to complain about how hard their job is, and then they just keep doing it over and over and over again. We just like to complain, really. Most engineers will tell you that.
What was the tech stack at Snagajob?
Oh my God, stack is the wrong word. Spaghetti. We were a .NET shop. I mean, Andrew, you're literally like asking all these questions so I can, they can't see my wrinkles, but now they can hear my wrinkles. We would do, you had to do upgrades at night, Saturday night at 3 a.m., which I guess is Sunday morning. You know, you would roll offline. And I remember one of the big innovations we had, we went from we would roll from one stack to the next stack. So you'd have your backup stack. Then when the power would go out, we would lose the AC. I mean, it's amazing to think that the internet still evolved despite how messy it was back in those days. I am sure 10 years, 20 years from now, they'll talk about how ridiculous our AWS instances are and how unsophisticated we are, but we've come a long way.
I've definitely seen some spit and duct tape data centers, yeah, you know, just like exactly. A marvel that anything functions in it.
And it's just incredible. I mean, my mom actually lives in Ashburn, Virginia, where every single data center is because of the AOL days, or I guess that's where the fiber core ran through it back in the day. And it is ridiculous to think that so much of the world is just run out of these random warehouses all along Route 28 near my mom's house.
So after Snagajob, you move on to Prezi and become head of product.
Yeah. So at Snagajob, I spent time, you know, leading product there and was a longtime user of Prezi, which is presentation software back in the day. And I really enjoyed it. So from Snagajob, I convinced the Prezi team to take me on and I really had a great time working back in software. It was like, you know, it's SaaS software, right? It's like the sweet spot between the velocity of consumer, the volume of consumer, but with the revenues of enterprise and B2B, like there's a lot to love about SaaS these days. And so I started at Prezi, another great tech stack. We were on Flash. So this is the greatest hits of tech stacks to not use. At Clipsys, I think I had a product or two that was AS400. I evolved to .NET. Then I evolved to Flash.
You do what you have to. Like we were working on a Flash product for a customer around then. And like, it was the only thing that would allow us to like record video off webcams in a browser. Like,
it worked, right? It was a great tech innovation. Yeah. I mean, cutting edge of the time, now passe, but Flash was fantastic for its purpose. You know, we were doing pan, zoom, you know, all sorts of different rendering volumes and speeds that was really hard to do in any other technology. And JavaScript hadn't caught up yet. And there are still times on Google Maps where I'm like, JavaScript's not there yet. If we had Flash, this would be easier. But here we are.
What was the customer base like, and did they love the product?
Yes. Oh, everybody loved Prezi. At the time, I guess we had probably 60 or 70 million users. They've grown a ton since then. And it was primarily used in the education space. So it was, you know, a competitor to PowerPoint. We were web-based. We were free to use. It was also like the early days of freemium and free trial, which today everybody talks about as like a new innovation. This was 2012. We just thought it was a good way to get people to try it. We had a big education customer base as well as student base, and we're catching on more and more with kind of business customers. But the roadmap became all about the rewrite off Flash and into JavaScript, which was necessary and absolutely the right thing to do. But as like a product person, like that's one JIRA ticket, right? Please rewrite this. It's a big JIRA ticket. You should probably break it down a little bit.
Yeah, there's a lot of story points on that one.
But you don't need product people at that point. So it was time to move on.
So a colleague of mine from back in the day, actually, when I first started working on .NET, Chris Bowen and I were doing a lot of .NET work. And there was this one big project that was coming up, and like it was, no one wanted to do it. And we were talking about phases, like phase one, phase two. He's like, oh yeah, that one's phase rail. I'm like, what's that? He's like, right after I leave.
It's perfect.
Someone else could deal with that one.
That's exactly, yeah. So that's exactly what I did at Prezi. I was like, oh, JavaScript rewrite, phase rail. I'll catch you guys later. Let me know how it goes. Call me in a couple of years.
So you move on from there to Hotel Tonight?
I did. So I'm a longtime traveler. This is my passion. And I know a lot of people say they love to travel, but I genuinely love to travel. And when I'm not traveling, I'm literally thinking of the next trip I'm going to take and researching. And fun fact, studies, I guess, show that when you look at the gratification you get out of a vacation, about 50% of that is accumulated during the planning phase. So just anticipating and thinking about and figuring out, you know, picking out which trails you're going to ski, whatever your vacation of choice is, half the gratification comes from the planning phase. So I'm that kid. I love travel. And I had been traveling a lot. And so I connected with Sam Shank, who's the CEO of Hotel Tonight. I guess they were probably at the time, maybe 10 or 15 people. And I was like, you need me as your head of product. And he was like, I don't need a head of product. Get out of here. I'm the CEO. I got product management under control. Don't worry about it. And maybe he was right. But a couple months later, I convinced him to take me on. And such started my 4-year run at Hotel Tonight, which was the best app and still, I think, the best app for hotel bookings.
When you say app, it was all apps, right? It was mobile everything.
Yeah, I know. Back to technology trends, right? Like we were iOS and Android only. I remember when we launched our Android app, my mom, who actually was a software engineer back in her time, would be like, I can't find your website. And I was like, yeah, because we're in an app. And she was like, crazy. But remember at the time, you know, it's 2012, 13, 14, like the iPhone, it was becoming commonplace, but you know, a lot of people were still on Blackberries and remember Palm. Those were still things. And so the idea that you would use a platform and that you would do anything different on your phone than make phone calls or maybe like click a link and read an article was crazy. We would do sales, you know, a couple nights stay at a hotel is $500. And so people were like, people will spend $500 on their cell phone. That's crazy. I mean, now Carvana, Shift, all these companies are selling cars on your cell phone. But at the time, you know, spend a couple $100 and make like that committed purchase without doing it on your desktop browser was just crazy to people. But yeah, we were mobile only. And then we eventually rolled out a mobile website. And then I guess eventually we really did do a full website in the end. It was a fun evolution.
So the whole premise was taking expiring inventory from hotels and trying to scrape some money out of it?
Yeah. Well, so there's actually decent money in hotel room bookings. And so what the idea was, you know, last minute hotel rooms, you know, tonight there's definitely going to be a hotel room empty at Choose Your Hotel, your Hyatt, your whatever. And particularly for non-branded hotels that have a hard time reaching customers, the incremental cost of that hotel room at the nicest property is $35 to clean it. So if you make $36 on that hotel room, you've still cleared $1 of profit. And so if that person even comes and then buys, you know, breakfast or, you know, a spa appointment or whatever, you know, you now suddenly have like an incremental customer that you never could have gotten. So because it was last minute, because it was spur of the moment, mobile made a ton of sense. You know, you're downtown, it's 8 o'clock at night, you finish dinner, you're like, screw it, I'm not driving back to the burbs. Like, let's just get a hotel room and stay. That was the idea of Hotel Tonight. So it was last minute hotel bookings. And we cleared tens of thousands of room nights every night.
What you just said there was interesting to me. Like, weren't people finding that, like, in New York City, for example, it might be cheaper to stay over than commute both ways?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think a third of our business in New York, which was a large portion of the business, was locals who didn't want to commute, right? The commute in New York is notoriously long. You know, pre-COVID, it was 90 minutes, 2 hours was not unusual. So you work late, you have a dinner, you stay for happy hour, and then you're like, forget it, I'll just stay the night. And so we had repeat customers who would just make Hotel Tonight part of their commute plan, I guess, you know, come into town for a concert and just grab a hotel room rather than fighting your way home on the train. It was amazing. We had a 2 a.m. cutoff. So you could book all the way up till 2 a.m. And some people got mad. They were like, why can't I book at 3 a.m.? And I was like, it's 3 a.m. Like, go to bed. Come on.
People at the hotel don't want to deal with you.
But, you know, okay. So nerdy tech things. But like, how do you deal with the date roll, right? So if you book at 1 a.m. on Saturday and for a Friday night stay, like, it's a little gnarly in terms of the calculating and the accounting and the figuring out when people stayed. And then you throw daylight savings time in. And like, if you ever wanted to find a bug in Hotel Tonight, just go to the daylight savings day and start messing with things. And for sure, there was a bug somewhere.
Yeah, there's a lot of places you can find that one. The spring forward, fall back.
The QA team loves me. They're like, really? Nobody's going to do that. I'm like, I know, but I found it.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features. To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So how do things end there at Hotel Tonight?
We ultimately got acquired by Airbnb, which is a fantastic group of people and another equally good product, kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum, with a lot more advanced bookings, a lot longer length of stay. Obviously, it's more homestays and less hotels. So there were a lot of compliments and they still coexist today, happily ever after.
But you decided, I don't really feel like being middle management at Airbnb.
Going back to my Eclipsis days, I learned quickly that if you were not the acquirer, you were the acquired. And things can turn out a little differently. And I decided it was not really for me to hang out at Airbnb and, you know, be middle management of the second place product. So I jumped off and took my first CEO job. I'd actually gotten a couple calls about a CEO job in the past and decided it was my time and I was ready to try it. I actually had been interviewing for a COO role and was the second runner-up candidate. So met with the recruiter. He's like, I think they should have picked you, but they didn't. And he's like, why did you want that job anyway? And I was like, well, I'm thinking about taking a CEO job someday. And he was like, then go be a CEO. And I was like, well, I'm not ready. And he was like, go be a CEO. And I was like, that's what you do? And he was like, yeah, go be a CEO. And he had three interviews lined up for me in a week. It was amazing. All you have to do is tell people what you want. It was a great lesson.
It's like a Jedi mind trick. You were a CEO. I'm a CEO.
It's true. And it worked. And then 6 weeks later, I was a CEO. And I was like, who's in charge around here? Oh, wait, it's me. This is crazy. I was also 32 weeks pregnant, which was another reason to think it was nuts. But there we were.
And so that was how you came to Rabbit?
That was how I came to Rabbit. Yeah. So Rabbit was a product for paired streaming. So if you and your partner were kind of long distance or you had friends from college, you want to watch the game together due to, you know, latency and ad insertion and different delays in the stream. And so we solved that problem by making it simultaneous zero latency replays of content. And so it was a very cool product, very popular, millions of users growing rapidly. Andreessen Bessemer backed a ton of teenage users who just wanted to watch shows together. Again, back to my mom being like, what do you guys do? But it was the kids loved it.
I think my daughter Caroline might have been a user because she had this friend. They lived little ways apart, but liked to stay in touch and they liked to watch content together. And they had something that they were using in order to be able to see it at the same time.
Probably. Yeah. The average user was kind of a teenager. You know, when I was a kid, we would literally like get on the wired phone, like drag the long phone cord out from the kitchen, the living room, and then sit silently and watch 90210. That was my experience. And so Rabbit was the modern way to do this, which was very cool. The challenge was we had no revenue and only 10 months of runway left. Cool product, not good business.
They only had 10 months of cash when you started?
Yeah.
Oh.
Things you learn the second time you're a CEO is to ask that question.
10 months might seem like forever at first.
10 months sound like a lifetime, right? To a product person, I'm like, oh, we can totally figure it out. No problem. Like, what could go wrong? But, you know, for anyone who runs a company or wants to run a company, take whatever timeline you have in minus 6 months, because that's when you need to deal with like fundraising and everything. So I really had 4 months. And did I mention the pregnant part? So I had to do a minor maternity leave. So we didn't have a ton of time to figure it out. And in the end, we were about to be acquired. And then that shifted to an investment and they were going to do a majority stake. And we were going to shift to like a sports strategy, which would have been a great play, particularly with sports betting where it is today. And I'm a huge sports fan. So just, you know, being able to watch my UVA Cavaliers through football and basketball, which you can't get in San Francisco. We have a lot of great things, but that is not one of them. So it would have been a great product, but we ran out of time. We were supposed to have the term sheet Friday. Friday becomes Monday. Monday, they pull it. Tuesday, emergency board meeting. We're going to shut it down. So Wednesday morning, got together with the lawyers and you're printing out everybody's severance papers, including my own, because we're shutting down. And I go into the office. People knew we were looking at an investment. So we'd had a lot of these meetings. And I guess someone had gotten the impression that we were going to announce funding. So there was like party music playing and we're like walking and it's like this open office space sort of to give the presentation. And I literally had like 5 more termination letters to print. So I like plug in my laptop. People are like chatting and party music's going and I'm like printing termination letters and I'm like, oh my God, this is awful. And yeah, and then I had to stand up and tell everybody that was the last day, we were shutting down. Keep your laptop, sign this form, 2 more paychecks coming, and that was the end. And then you have to have somebody who continues to work and sign for the company. So no paychecks, but I got to stick around and keep working for the next 4 weeks.
I don't think the touchy-feely class could have prepared you for that experience.
No, nothing really prepares you for that experience. You're literally staring down people's faces and like, you know, them, their partners, their kids, like, it's so hard. And, you know, like the CEO job is such a hustle. Like all you want to do is do right by your customers, do right by your investors, do right by your employees. And when I came to terms at that moment that I couldn't bring it all together and make it happen, it was just devastating. Like you want to be anywhere but there. Maybe I guess what touchy-feely taught me was how to like have hard conversations and like face the news, but it was awful. And it was awful for everybody. It's shed no tears for me. Like it is so hard to do layoffs. Like, oh, just so hard.
Well, you got some experience, but I think I've said before on Underserve, experience is what you get when you don't get what you wanted.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it makes a good, you know, podcast story, makes a nice resume builder. And I'll tell you, it makes me paranoid, right? So I spend a lot of time today really studying our finances. We've always run CoderPad as a profitable company for that reason, because I'm never going to do that again. I'm never doing that to my employees. I'm never doing that to my customers. I remember, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, it was not cool necessarily to be profitable. And people be like, but you could spend twice as much and grow faster. And I'm like, yeah, but then we'd run out of money. They'd be like, no, just go do another fundraise. And I was like, well, I don't want to count on that to happen. And so, I mean, I had job candidates we were trying to hire who wouldn't come because they didn't feel like our growth was fast enough or that we had enough opportunity. And I was like, this is crazy. Where are we in this world? And then here we are today where suddenly profitable growth is cool. Thank God. So maybe we're cool again.
So after a short stint as an entrepreneur in residence, you become CEO of CoderPad. Sounds like you took some of your lessons learned and are bringing them to the company. What's it been like?
Yeah, it's been a ton of fun. So we're almost 3 years, I guess 2.5 years into CoderPad. We're the leading platform for assessing developer talent. So we started as a live interview only product. So we work with all the big fangs. I like to say all the big fangs except the G and Google. We work with the alphabet pieces, but not the G. We're the tool of choice for interviewing developers there. And so it's been fun to like scale that business. It was started by a technical founder who kind of ended up running a business and didn't want to. You know, he had 1,500 customers and a couple million in revenue. And he was like, I don't want to do this. Like, this sucks. And so an investor group found the business and called me and said, hey, I think you might be a good fit. And I was like, CoderPad? I know CoderPad. We use CoderPad at Hotel Tonight. We use CoderPad at Airbnb. And so it was fun to get started and then really try to scale it. You know, we're now over 4,000 customers. Along the way, using some of my M&A experience, we ended up acquiring another company out of Europe for an adjacent product. So it's been fun to put the suite of products together. It's been fun to work internationally. It's been fun to hear how recruiting works for developers, you know, in the EU or EMEA, as we like to think of the market, and, you know, how different it is. And with the globalization of tech and all the trends that are happening in terms of, you know, most people are working out of a living room. What does it matter whether that living room is really in France or that living room is in Boston or that living room is in San Francisco? It's been exciting to see how those trends are changing. And, you know, what I really want to drive forward with this company is finding a way for developers of all skills to be able to show their skills and get hired, right? I think particularly in San Francisco, too much of it is about, did you work at Google? Did you go to Stanford? Do you have a CS degree? None of that actually matters. I think probably most of the people listening to that know that too, but the recruiters don't. And so, you know, it's our job to say, hey, look, I don't care if you have a degree in fine arts. I don't care if you don't even have a degree. I don't care if you're self-taught, because that's what most people are doing these days. And you're building a machine at 12, 13. Like, you don't need a CS degree because you know most of it. And as long as you get the foundational knowledge, you can pick up the languages. So how do we help people who have those skills really break into the job market and then ultimately create better technology products, right? I mean, there's too much built in this town by very privileged people who look at that went to the same schools, worked at the same places and solved the same problems. I think we would solve better problems with software if we actually had a more diverse set of people working on it.
Now, it's really kind of like a full-fledged IDE in a browser where you're kind of remotely pair programming and there's video. Like,
yeah.
It's become quite a rich suite.
Full IDE, yeah. Console, you know, 30, 40 languages supported, 10 different frameworks. The idea is really that you can drop in and do your kind of basic software programming 101 question if you wanted to. I always like to pick on reversing a binary tree because it's stupid and everybody seems to ask it.
Write me a linked list iterator, like CS 101.
Exactly. You can do that in CoderPad. It's not what we really are endeavoring to help support. But what you can also do is drop in, you know, real pieces of code and talk about how would you add a feature set to this code base, or how would you debug this problem, or how can we pair together to, you know, think through how we would build out an API to support, you know, whatever the new feature set is. Because that's actually what the development job is. The development job is not linked lists and binary trees. The development job is like, here's probably a gnarly set of code base that you need to work your features into it without breaking other people's stuff, and be able to give reasonable comments when someone else sends in a pull request. And so how do you actually test for those skills? Collaboration, thoughtfulness, thinking through problems, not just, you know, do your inputs and outputs match?
I think you said you can also like record and play back sessions, which seems like it'd be really useful since it's so hard to get a panel on an interview at the same time.
Right. And it's a candidate experience to have like six people staring at one poor candidate who's like, you know, I share my screen during an all hands and like try to type one line into a slide and get nervous because I'm spell checking like crazy. Imagine how those candidates feel. It's actually a stress test. So yeah, we record the sessions so you can have a one-on-one interview and then you can spread your panel, right? So if you've got six interviewers, you can now do six simultaneous interviews with six different candidates. And then you bring up the playbacks and you can say like, who had the best output? Where did you have to help in the process? Like, can we actually judge this based on output? Not, I liked the person, we went to the same school, we know the same people. Like, you're doing it based on work samples, which creates a much more fair process for interviewing and can create diversity in the system. Fun fact, fact about technical interviews. So there's a researcher named Chris Parnon at NC State who studies technical interviewing. And he looked at the origins of technical interviews. And if you study how they used to do testing in psych tests in the 50s and 60s around understanding how your blood changed or what the chemicals were that induced stress, the way they actually constructed those tests was to put you in front of a whiteboard, give you a pen, give you complicated math problems to do while people watched you and were talking. That was like the most stressful environment they could come up with. And he was like, oh my God, that's a technical interview. And it's true. Like, we're not actually testing people for technical interviews. At some point, you're just stress testing people. So why don't you give them a natural environment, give them an IDE, let them do their work, assess their code at the end and see like which had the better outcome and who actually went through the process collaboratively with you rather than this like competitive stress test experience that so many people have had.
And I think there's no shame in a little Google or Stack Overflow check on the way too, because that's how most people work.
I know. And the number of times a recruiter will be like, I want to know if they left the tab and they went and checked it somewhere else. I'm like, because you think resourceful candidates are better candidates? Me too. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, that's resourceful. You don't want someone who's memorized stuff. Like, I need you to find the answers. I don't need you to memorize them.
Now, the acquisition you did, was that around kind of auto grading of coding?
Yeah. So the acquisition we did was more of the asynchronous testing platform. So as much as I believe strongly in this live interviewing experience, there are a number of roles where even doing an asynchronous upfront test check will matter. Think about your junior developer roles, your intern programs, kind of your high volume hiring. eBay once told me they get 10,000 applications for every engineering role they post.
Wow.
And I'm like, really? Can I have just one? Just 1% of that candidate flow, please. You know, if you take a look at those resumes, how does a recruiter know who to call back? Well, they don't, which is then when the recruiter's like, well, who went to Stanford? Do I recognize the company they work for? Do they have a CS degree? And that at the beginning of the process is when the bias starts. It's not necessarily the end. It's the recruiters who are trying to make choices with no information and just need a little bit of a rubric to score candidates. And when all they have is a resume or a CV, that's what they get. But if you can give the recruiters a tool and have them get feedback from the candidates on like who actually has mastery of these skills, who really understands whatever language you're testing for, who really has foundational knowledge on engineering computer science concepts, let's move them into the interview process first and, you know, find a way to kind of sort the list. So that's what the product does. It's called Coding Game. They also have a whole community of almost 3 million developers now who go in regularly and do coding challenges against each other and kind of compete. Sometimes they're sponsored by companies. Sometimes the companies do them internally for a competition, or they'll do it externally as a recruiting tool. But how do you, you know, show off your skills? Again, like you could be an anonymous person anywhere, no CS degree, didn't go to Stanford, don't even live, you know, in Europe, don't live in the US. And like, you just want to show your mastery and show your skills. So that's what the Coding Game platform does. It's very cool.
That sounds like it might be addictive and become as popular as watching like chess on Twitch or something like that.
Yes, it is a little addictive. We do sometimes have happy hours over the spring challenges and kind of watch people compete with each other. It's interesting. It's a ton of fun. And I love it because the founder of that company, he's the youngest of four and his parents were skiers in the French Alps, which sounds glamorous until you're probably the person who grew up in the French Alps with your parents working all weekend and you're alone by yourself in your house. Because of that, he was a self-taught engineer. Out of high school was like, I'm just going to skip university and go get a job. No one would hire him because he didn't have the right resume. So he went back to university, did the 4 years, didn't learn very much, came out and got all these great job offers. And he's like, this whole recruiting process is broken. And so that's what he's been endeavoring to solve. And I just love his spirit in that and how it plays all the way through the product.
So when you actually tear yourself away from the keyboard and put your phone on Do Not Disturb, are there any hobbies or activities you enjoy?
I don't think I've ever done that. Hobbies? Well, that's nice of you to ask. I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. They're currently my hobbies. So somewhere between soccer practice, gymnastics, dance lessons, birthday parties. My favorite is the trampoline park, though. Pro tip for the parents. That's a good way to get their exercise out and yours. Those are probably my best hobbies. I do love travel, as we talked about, and my younger self used to run marathons. And so maybe my older self will also run marathons once I can convince these kids to drive themselves or take an Uber somewhere.
How about activism or philanthropy? Anything that you're involved in or passionate about?
Well, for those who know me well, know I do nothing in a small way. I'm actually the president of our local school board. We are part of a charter school here in San Francisco City, Thomas Edison Charter Academy. And so I'm the president of the Board of Education. So I spent a lot of time working on the school. It's actually been very eye-opening to see how a different organization runs, right? Like CoderPad's a company, and we certainly have our governance and finance and performance indicators. And schools are no different. They have their governance and their financials that they have to keep in health, and then look at your performance indicators and how are students doing, not just academically, but from a well-being perspective. So I spend a decent amount of time probably worrying about education and making my kids very embarrassed when I come on campus, for sure.
That's part of the job description.
Exactly. Welcome to the next 15 years of your life.
Well, Amanda, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your thoughts and experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Of course. Awesome. It was great to see you, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.